Thanks for listening to The Rest Is Politics. Sign up to The Rest Is Politics Plus to enjoy ad-free listening, receive a weekly newsletter, join our members' chat room, and gain early access to live show tickets. Just go to therestispolitics.com. That's therestispolitics.com.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics with me, Alistair Campbell.
And me, Rory Stewart.
And it's been quite a day. The very, very good news that Suella Braverman, who should never have been appointed in the first place, has finally been sacked as Home Secretary. And the sort of jaw-dropping news that David Cameron, former Prime Minister, is now back as the new Foreign Secretary. Lots of other changes still going on around us. We'll come on to those in a minute. Anyway, as a result of that, we listened to you all, those of you who said there must be an emergency podcast, so we hit the button.
That's wonderful. And we can see an amazing stream of comments already coming in. I don't know whether you've ever done these things, Alistair, but we've got about 75 comments in already saying things like Alistair and Rory for King and Queen, or petition to make Gary Neville the Foreign Secretary.
I'm very glad it was in that order.
Very good. So anyway, for those of you who are listening on the podcast, we're doing things a bit differently. We're recording a live and interactive podcast on YouTube. If you're listening to this on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you might get your podcast, this might sound a bit different than usual. We'll be reacting to news as well as taking live questions from listeners on the live stream.
And if any of your friends are sort of doing terrible things like having a day job and unable to join us now, this will go out as it were, normal podcast as soon as we get all the sort of graphics and that stuff put on there. So let's get going, Rory. Pretty big potatoes, I'd say. Whether it will change the dial of our politics, I'm not sure. But my God, wouldn't I have liked to have been... I've been trying to get Tony Blair to talk to me about what it was like backstage at the Cenotaph yesterday. Because if you think that there's Sunak walking in front of the former prime ministers, including David Cameron, who probably has already lined up, past James Cleverly, who's about to shift from a job that he wants to keep to one that he doesn't necessarily want to do, then past Braverman, who he's about to sack. Braverman and Cleverly then lay a wreath together, and then they all troop in backstage to have tea and cakes.
Would it be great? Yeah, well, we need to get your friend Tony on to talk about it. So I think the first thing, just to, I guess, set the context for reshuffles, this is going to be a very big deal, obviously, for Rishi Sunak. He won't have waited until this morning to line up David Cameron for the job. Obviously, you don't ask the person into Downing Street if they're going to say no. So he probably will have lined him up a few days ago, and they will have been waiting for the timing. What's the right time to get rid of Suella Braverman? And I guess one of the calculations was, why not do it on Thursday? Why not do it on Friday? Why not do it on Saturday? And I'm guessing the answer is that they were waiting to see how the demonstrations panned out. What's your view on the timing bit?
I think if he was talking to David Cameron about coming in as Foreign Secretary, I think that sounds to me like a done deal. Once they'd sorted out a few questions, I suspect they've had to sort out questions about how David Cameron becomes accountable from the House of Lords. They'll have had to sort out questions which they'll be asked about money. David Cameron is on a former Prime Minister allowance, which is a very, very large whack of cash. Does he also take a full salary alongside that? All the sort of difficult questions they'd have probably asked about the politics of whether he now has to go out as a defender of the government's Brexit position, which we know he doesn't support. Does this make austerity more difficult for the government, given that he's, as it were, with Osborne, its chief, architect. I think they'll have gone through that. Cameron will then have said, okay, I'm up for it. I think he would have, Braverman, of course, has lobbed in this hand grenade of the article in the Times undermining the police. I don't think they could have done anything of this nature over the weekend, either on the Saturday because of the protests going on the Sunday because of the armistice, because of the Remembrance Day events in Whitehall themselves. So I think he probably did have it for the Monday. And of course, it does mean there are consequential changes. So Cameron goes in as Foreign Secretary, Braverman out, James Cleverly. And he said, you know, I said to Fiona yesterday when we were watching the Cenotaph, I said, that is going to be a picture. You know, when the two of them walk together.
Mm-hmm.
And Fiona has been saying for a while now, and I think she may have a point, that Cleverly is probably more of a contender for the leadership than Braverman. Braverman, I don't think, does have the support that she thinks she has. I think she has a lot of vanity and a lot of ambition. I'm not sure she has support. But to see the two of them together, that must have been a moment and a half for Sunak. He watches them, and he's the only person that knows what he's about to do, probably.
Amazing. Well, let's take it back to the question of what it means to firstly get rid of Braverman, and then we'll move on to what it means to get rid of to bring in Cameron. So, getting rid of Braverman first. I think the first thing is, obviously, you've been pushing for it for a long time. You've been saying it's very important. And I think it's a litmus test of whether a prime minister is able to keep authority in his own cabinet. I mean, she broke the rules. She was supposed to clear an article that she didn't clear. And it's also a question, I guess, of his moral values. He's been clearly allowing Suella Braverman to remain in the cabinet, saying things that we presume that he's uncomfortable with for a long time. And I've explained it in terms of fights within the Conservative Party. He's now got rid of her. What do you think are the risks that she will be a sort of martyr and the Conservative Party will now tear themselves to pieces?
Well, I think she's a symptom of them tearing themselves to pieces anyway. You've said several times that the Conservative Party has almost become like a sort of series of factions. I think she will, you know, she said she sort of was channeling Arnold Schwarzenegger. She basically was saying, you know, I'll be back. You know, you haven't heard the last of me kind of thing. I think she will cause trouble. I think, look, if you're going to cause trouble for a prime minister while you're literally sitting at his right hand inside the cabinet, then the idea you're going to stop causing trouble for him once you're out of the cabinet is a nonsense. She'll cause trouble. The question is whether it has traction. And I think my sense is what Sunak is trying to do by bringing back Cameron, some of the other changes. There's a mixed picture of the other changes. We'll come on to those. But I think what he's trying to do, frankly, is do what he should have done when he came over, when he first moved into Downing Street from number 11, which is to get the Conservative Party to a more sensible, grown-up position. My worry, if I were him, was whether, frankly, it's all too late and whether the questions that are going to surround David Cameron related to Brexit, related to austerity, related to his financial dealings. I think the Greensill thing, we'll hear a lot about that again. Mm. But I think with Braverman, it's intolerable. You cannot have a prime minister who is willfully and deliberately undermined in the way that she undermined him last week. You just cannot tolerate that.
So let's start with the fact that, in a sense, he's got no option other than to get rid of her. I was talking to an MP this morning as the news came through, and he said, whoa, quite a lot of my constituents have got quite a lot of sympathy with Suella Braverman and agree with quite a lot of the things she says. So I guess that's one type of risk. I don't know how many of those people are, but maybe there's 20, 25% of the public who sympathize with a lot of what Braverman says, sympathize with her on immigration, on boats, probably agree with her on they may not agree with her about her comments about homeless people, but they probably don't like seeing tents in cities. They probably don't like, and this is a very sensitive point, but I'm assuming that there are a lot of voters out there, and some of my constituents would have been like this, who do not like the sight of people walking through London with balaclavas on and Islamist bandanas, because it reminds them of ISIS and terrorism and Islamist demonstrations. And so there's a possibility that she may try to use this issue to position herself in the sort of anti-woke vote.
She will do that, without a doubt, and there is a constituency for that. But the other thing we shouldn't forget is that her record as Home Secretary has been pretty hopeless. Now, that can now disappear into the ether because she no longer does the job. And what you'll see happen, the way the media will treat her now will be very different, because they will see her as somebody who's going to be interesting because she can undermine the people who are now in power. But I think there'll be, I think she underestimates how much she's undermined herself by the manner of her conduct. Most people, maybe not all these Tory party members who gave us Truss and gave us Johnson, but I think most decent people actually, whatever they think of the Prime Minister, don't like somebody who's out there just sort of deliberately undermining them for their own ambition. And also the stuff that you were quoting there, that people support her on, it is, to my mind, it's the populist stuff. I don't believe she thinks for a second that sending people to Rwanda is the way to resolve the boats problem. I don't believe for a second that she actually thinks it's a genuine, you know, it's a crisis facing the country that makes the Prime Minister make it one of his five priorities. It's classic populism. Now, I think Sunak, if he's got any sense at all, in my view, will use this as the moment to signal real change. But I just think it may be too late.
Can I just bring in the comments coming down the right hand side of the screen? So we don't normally have this going on, and they've been pouring in so fast. It's very difficult to keep up with because I'm trying to concentrate on you, and my eyes is going to these comments. But it's going everywhere from people saying 25% of people nothing like that, and people saying 0.01% of the 300,000 demonstrations, to other people coming in saying it's 75%. You left wing nut, you know. So that's an extraordinary kind of running commentary on this.
That's Rory. Can I just tell you, it's why I never look at comments on Twitter. I occasionally dip in, but I'm sure that. But I'm trying to sort of. Here's a good one. Well, let's just explain this. Why is David Cameron returning by entering the House of Lords even legal? By my reckoning, he's at least since what we might call modern times, going back, you know, last century, I think he's the sixth foreign secretary who's done the job from the House of Lords. So it's certainly not illegal. It's a bit Victorian for sure.
Yeah. Can I just come in on that? It really has a Victorian feel. So people will remember that traditionally cabinet ministers could come from the House of Lords or the House of Commons. We had prime ministers who came from the House of Lords back in the Victorian era. So, famously, lots of these people, Lord Salisbury would be an example, mm-hmm. and foreign secretaries, people like Lord Palmerston, Duke of Wellington. But it's been a pretty long time in British politics since this has happened. The famous recent or relatively recent example that people remember is Alec Douglas-Hume, who'd been the prime minister, then being brought back to be foreign secretary. But of course, that's more than 50 years ago now.
Yeah, you had Carrington under Thatcher, and he resigned over the Falklands, but he wasn't the previous prime minister. You had Douglas Hume, as you say, Lord Halifax, and before them, Lord Reading and Lord Curzon.
Yeah.
And we
Lord
can now
Reading, add, I think someone's going to correct me, but I think Lord Reading had been an MP before he entered the House of Lords.
Correct. And I think that, so David Cameron adds himself, dare we use your distinguished word, Rory? Is this a distinguished list or not?
Well, it's a very interesting list. I mean, Lord Reading, Marquess of Reading, was a very interesting figure at the early 20th century. He was Jewish, and he was incredibly able. He'd been, I think, Secretary of State for India, but it was a big reach for him to become Foreign Secretary. And one of the questions that's been asked on Twitter, which I want to stop you on for a second before we
it's
get
not
on
Twitter,
to
Twitter, or it's not
merits,
Twitter.
Sorry.
It's not
on
Twitter.
The side of
it's the
live
YouTube feed.
Comment.
It's the live feed.
Live feed YouTube.
By the way, Rory, you probably listened to one, but an Austrian listener has just asked either of one of us to become Chancellor of Austria. So that's quite.
Well,
nice.
I was trying to obviously in our last leading interview try to convince Arnold Schwarzenegger to do that, but he wasn't having any of it, was he?
No, he wouldn't have it. He wouldn't have it.
So one of the things that came in on the feed is somebody saying, "Why didn't he bring in William Hague?" And I think there's a very, very strong likelihood that he tried to get in William Hague, and William Hague said no.
The other thing you never know about these reshuffles until they're kind of over, and even then you might never find out the full picture. But my understanding is that James Cleverly really did not want to do this, that he felt that he was doing a genuinely important job at an incredibly difficult time with the Middle East thing going on. To be fair to him, I think I said to you in a previous podcast, he has been holding the line for a more serious approach on this, where he brings David Lammy in, that he briefs Keir Starmer fully and that sort of thing, and that they tried to build a kind of consensus position. Whereas you've had the Bravermans and the Goves who've been really wanting to stir this up for Labour, as it were. And I think he sort of felt that he was a bit of a round peg in a round hole, and now he's been shipped out just because she was doing the job in a way that was annoying Sunak. And we should also put in the newsletter, there was a wonderful article which somebody sent me today from The Independent, just after a few days after Sunak became Prime Minister. And the headline that was Sunak, no regrets over appointing Braverman. And saying that he felt that she'd learnt her lessons and nothing like this would ever happen again. Now, Rory, there's a question just gone through. Would Rory accept a lordship and go into the cabinet for Rishi Sunak?
I, if someone had offered me the chance to be foreign secretary, I definitely would have accepted. You would have lost your podcast co-host.
Right. Okay.
Stuart. No, I think. No, I.
So,
I think,
so your crawling messages to Rishi, just is that what they were about?
Those just didn't work, did they? Obviously, yeah. Didn't work. I I've not been complimentary enough on the podcast about the whole conservative machine.
Now, can I give you a quiz question? How many foreign secretaries have there been since Brexit?
Foreign secretaries since Brexit. Well, I can try to count it, can't I? So it was William Hague, Philip Hammond, Jeremy Hunt. Boris Johnson, Jeremy Hunt. So I'm going to go for seven.
It's seven. You're absolutely right. Yep. This is the seven since we've had eight environment secretaries since 2016. I'll give you £1 million if you can list them within 30 seconds.
I once almost got £1 million off you.
You
trying
did,
to do
you
that.
Did, you did. I'll tell you, Liz Truss, Andrea Leadsom, Michael Gove, Theresa Villiers, George Eustace, I'd forgotten this guy existed, Ranul Jayawardena, Therese Coffey, and now Steve Barclay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 16 housing ministers, as I said. We had 6 health secretaries. There's a great question from Jason Peel. Rory, you could have been the first podcasting foreign secretary.
Actually, it would be amazing for Britain's soft power, isn't it? We could sort of rethink the Foreign Office. We could
exactly.
Just do our great podcast explainers. Okay, let me slow this down for a bit so that we're not completely distracted by the live feed.
And yeah, I'm not going to look at them for a while.
Question of the advantages and disadvantages of bringing in David Cameron. I'll have a first stab and then I'm going to hand you. So, advantage. Of course, it seems quite strong to have a former prime minister coming in to work for you. So it seems like quite a confident thing that a former prime minister would agree to be underneath you. I think David Cameron has an advantage that he knows a lot of these world leaders very well. So he wouldn't only be able to have the normal access for foreign secretary, but if he flies around the world, I suspect the heads of state will come in and say hello as well. I think he represents, for many people, somebody who, despite the catastrophic referendum, was at least on the Remain side, and in 2010 represented compassionate conservatism and a slightly more left-wing vision of the Conservative Party. So could be a move towards reconciliation, and you can make that case for some of the other people that he's brought in. Victoria Atkins was also more on the Remain side. And then the case against, I think there's going to be an enormous amount over the next few days of people going through what David Cameron has been doing with his finances over the last 6-7 years, lobbying, representing. So there'll be a real attempt to do that. I don't know whether journalists will find something, but that's going to be a big risk, because that would change the story round from we've brought in a dignified big hitter to suddenly the newspapers being dominated by scandals around David Cameron. Yeah. And I think the other thing is, at some point, getting into what his real record is on foreign affairs. I mean, I felt, working for him, I got often very frustrated. I began to, obviously, once we saw the ERG going and Boris Johnson coming in, I began to miss him more. But at the time, 2010 to 2016, I was often very much at loggerheads with him on foreign policy. Anyway, over to you.
I've got, you know how I love my little letter things. I've got an ABC, which I think is a bit of a problem. Austerity, Brexit, China. He was the architect of austerity. That's going to be a big part of Labour's campaign. He is the guy who gave us the referendum, which has given us a lot of the mess that we often talk about. And I think for the Conservative Party, his views on China. Now, I'm sure he's a very slick, professional politician. He'll, whatever Sunak is sort of, you know, he'll find a way of adapting. But I think that could be, that could become a problem. And the Greensill stuff, that story kind of, you know, came and went. But Lex Greensill, as I understand it, is still under a criminal investigation over dealings in which David Cameron earned $10 million for lobbying. So all it would need would be something that we don't know to sort of trigger that one to come out again. And then it looks like Sunak's reset has gone off kilter again. And people will be looking for that. I think it's only fair, Rory, as you've got a book out at the moment called Politics on the Edge, that we should take a little bit of a look of, I've just had a quick look through the index, the David Cameron index. I've got to say, I think he comes worse out of your book than he does out of mine. first of all, and it might be related to the fact that I think the first mention, it's basically him telling somebody that you're the last sort of person that they want in, the last kind of person they want in Parliament. You basically say he's obsessed with the news and the news agenda. You weren't impressed by the fact that he considered himself to be an expert on Afghanistan because he's flown there for a few day trips. You thought backbenchers are sidelined by him. He was too sort of in hoc to financial services people. And let me just remind you, Roy, this may not help your future career, but I have to tell you, this is your judgment on his approach to foreign policy. This is after he left. I did not regret his departure. Partly, I had not liked the way he approached foreign policy. He hadn't challenged the global financial system or questioned Obama's approach to Afghanistan. I felt he'd failed to prepare for a military threat from Russia, good point, and mishandled Libya and Syria and misjudged his charm offensive on China. Pretty damning, Rory.
Yeah, I don't think he's about to appoint me as an ambassador anytime soon.
Either inside or outside the House of Lords.
No, no.
What's all that about? But you do, you said before that you thought he was superficial.
Yeah, I think if I step back for a second, I think he is somebody who is very much a product of the 90s. He kind of came of age at the time the Berlin Wall fell. That's when he began his sort of political career. He went into politics very early, straight from university. And his worldview was very much dominated by that. It was, and we talk about that era from about 1989 to 2005 a lot. And 2005 is when he became Conservative Party leader, and that's when David Cameron's character was formed. So it was the era of John Major. It was, of course, the era of you and Tony Blair. It was an era when the US was unchallenged in the world, where the number of democracies in the world was doubling, where the world was becoming more peaceful and prosperous all the time, where there was this idea of liberal intervention, responsibility to protect, the interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo that seemed to go well. All of that was what created him. And he never saw really how the world changed in 2005. He didn't see how the financial crisis was going to change things. He didn't see how Iraq and Afghanistan were going to humiliate foreign policy. He didn't really take on board the widening inequalities that were emerging. He remained somebody who, from 2010 onwards, and I think this is probably true of Ed Miliband and Ed Balls too, they're all the same generation. They're all part of the same products. Continued to act as late as 2015 as though they were still in that 89 to 2005 period. And my question really is, as foreign secretary, can he adapt to a very, very different world order where Britain, in 2005, when he became Conservative Party leader, the British economy was still larger than the Chinese economy. It's now seven times smaller than the Chinese economy. Mm-hmm. So can he adjust to a very, very different world? Anyway, over to you.
We'll see in the next few days a sort of reaction. I think within the Conservative Party, it's made those who are not on the right, the hard right, like Braverman, feel slightly happier with life, I suspect. I think it's saying to them, Sunak has decided that this whole sort of, you know, bang the drum, stop the votes, populize everything, isn't doing them any good. The by-elections were a disaster for them. They seem to be going backwards in most parts of the country. I wonder if also, because of who and what Cameron represents, the kind of conservatism he represents, whether it's partly Sunak saying, look, I think for much of the Red Wall, we're going to have to let it go. But the way that where they're watching their backs is in the so-called Blue Wall. And I think what this is partly about is trying to turn a lot of those don't knows in the polls, who are probably former Tories, back into the Tory camp. I think that's what this is about. But I think it's a bit late. And I think also it shows that, I remember my one of my great heroes on strategy, Garry Kasparov, says never change the strategy unless the fundamentals change. I don't believe the fundamentals have actually changed. They haven't changed since Sunak became prime minister. What's changing is his approach to it, but I don't believe it's because he actually needs to do this now. It's that he didn't do it when he should have done it.
Do you think they're going to? I'm mesmerizing what's going on in the live stream. I get all these people saying, why is Rory drinking a whole flagon of tea? Has he texted congratulations to David Cameron yet? Since I've got that 11 times, I'm going to respond. I don't think David Cameron likes me very much. And I think my texting him congratulations might go down like a bit of cold soup. I have. You have.
I've said to him, I'll read you exactly what I said to him. It says, well, I said, brackets done, brackets. Don't you think this is the perfect time for a 3-hour special on The Rest is Politics? Let's see what he replies, Rory.
Oh, how wonderful.
That'd be a great place to get all his views out on foreign
Absolutely,
policy.
And put me in my place. Would it? Do you think they're going to use David Cameron now much more in the media? That they'll put him out to do the Sunday shows, that he'll become much more of a spokesman as they go into a next election?
Well, he's quite a good communicator. I mean, I think he's a better communicator than Sunak by a long way, better communicator than Hunt. They might do, but I think it's a big risk because what people will want to do, and even the sort of client journalists, of which there are many, will want to sort of get into the guts of what this is all about. They'll want to sort of explore all the divisions. He won't get away, I think, with doing interviews without being pressed on Brexit, on austerity, and on some of the big foreign policy decisions that you talked about. Robert Shrimsley at the Financial Times, who is, quite acerbic, but also quite a serious journalist. I don't know if you saw his tweet. It just said, time to do a thread on David Cameron's previous foreign policy achievements. They just said 1 out of 1. So there was no thread. So I think it would be, look, it's given what I think about this in general. I think it's bold. I think it's made them a bit more interesting for a bit. It means we're talking about Braverman now in the past, which is, I think, quite a good thing for...
So just to interrupt, Alistair, one thing possibly that they're doing there is you're suggesting that it actually suits number 10 also because it moves the story on from Braverman's bitterness to the question of Cameron.
To the question of Cameron and also the question of whether this is Sunak trying to do a really genuine repositioning. So, for example, we've got the Rwanda case coming up in the courts. Now, I hear from sources close to sources who know lawyers, I hear that actually the government, there's a very good chance the government's going to win this. If that's the case, be interesting to see how the reaction is. But if they lose it, what Braverman was all lined up to do was to go for this pull out of the European Convention on Human Rights. Well, both Cameron and James Cleverly now, who's taken over from at the Home Office, both of them are on record as saying that would be a very, very stupid thing to do. So that presumably is dead. Does that then provoke these ERG people? The truth is, though, this is what I tried via the podcast to tell Sunak and his people from the word go. You can't trade with these people. You have to do your own thing and understand that between now and the general election, Sunak is pretty much safe. He's going to be there. If he's not, then the Tories are done. I mean, and they might as well just all go home and not even bother having an election. There's another interesting appointment, I thought, Rory. Greg Hands, the Tory chairman, has been moved. Just business. I think he did that before. And the new guy, Richard Holden, I suspect that's a new name to most of our listeners. But it suggests to me that Sunak still needs to have a few basic lessons about politics because this guy's got a majority of 1,144.
Yeah.
Now, to be the party chairman, where you have to become a high-profile defender of everything the government does and in the campaign, if that's your majority, I think he can wave bye-bye to his seat. So
it's an interesting one, isn't it? Often you're looking for people to put into party chairmen who are real campaigners who really fight elections. And of course, someone with a marginal seat like that, small majority, is somebody who had to work very, very hard on winning their seat, keeping their seat. But you're right. I mean, this is what happened to Chris Patten, who was the chairman for John Major and ended up losing his own seat as the chairman. Although Chris Patten went on to do pretty well afterwards. Other bits of the reshuffle. So Steve Barclay will be frustrated. He was health secretary. He was meant to be...
I don't think the NHS will be frustrated.
No, the NHS not be frustrated.
But
that's a very interesting move and will lead to some very strange dynamics around the cabinet table, because Steve Barclay was very much brought in. He's an ex-management consultant, I think a former accountant, to come in and really focus on remodeling the NHS. And a lot more money was put into the NHS. And he will feel, rightly or wrongly, that he's had the legs cut out from him in the middle of what he was trying to do. And he's been moved to the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, which is a less senior position. You actually know it. I mean, when I was sitting at the cabinet table, you literally see ministers moved down the table. The seniority is how close you are to the prime minister. So he will be literally shifted down the table.
And he's now basically become Fergal Sharkey's shadow.
Fergal Sharkey's shadow. And but of course, very frustrating for farmers and people who care about the environment to get a sense that DEFRA is a sort of second best job.
Minette Batters on leading, she said it was just so frustrating to keep seeing these people moving around. And we've never had churn like this. And yet again, these ones who get sacked will get a nice big fat payoff. I see Nick Gibb is going. He must be about the longest serving minister.
So Nick Gibb is the other end of the spectrum. We often talk about how quickly people are reshuffled. But Nick Gibb has been in almost continuously as a junior education minister, Minister of State and Education, since 2010.
Yeah.
Which is 13 years, which means, and most civil servants, senior civil servants, are often only in the role for a couple of years. So Nick Gibb will have seen six cycles of civil servants go through. Another example of that was George Eustace, who didn't do quite as long, but was a junior minister and then the Secretary of State in DEFRA for a very, very long time. Mm. Nick Gibb has stepped down saying that he's going to go on, seems to be an ambassador somewhere. He's somebody who there was a lot of affection for in the House of Commons. He represented something unusual, somebody who seemed to be willing to be a junior minister in a department and put in a dozen years. He put a lot of focus on improving British students' scores in maths and seems to be quite effective at that, gone up the PISA tables on maths, gone up on literacy. But I know that Fiona, your wife, who follows this very closely, wasn't always a fan. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, I was in a school today, and I think most people in the education sector, the state education sector, when you talk about Nick Gibb, they think he and Gove between them have done an awful lot of damage. There's a great question here from Sam Hills. I wonder if Alistair regrets turning down a peerage now that he would have had the opportunity to hold a sitting member of the cabinet to account. It will be interesting. I see David Lammy, the shadow foreign secretary, has put out a statement saying that, you know, there needs to be some way that Cameron is answerable to MPs. I mean, and I guess this is the other thing that will happen, because he obviously can't turn up in the House of Commons and the Lords is much more sort of gentle in the way that it debates. I suspect the select committees will be gagging to get Cameron up before them.
Yeah. Well, this question of accountability is really important. And I wonder, as we think about the Constitution, why exactly we couldn't be bold and say that a Secretary of State who's in the Lords can't go into the Commons and answer questions there. I know the answer is that, nobody who isn't elected a member of the House of Commons is allowed to pass into the Commons chamber and all this sort of thing. But the principle of accountability seems to me pretty fundamental. Mm. And remind us a little bit about Mandelson, because people were surprised by this, but it's not the first time it's happened recently.
No,
remind us a bit about that. Yeah.
Well, when Gordon became Prime Minister, he Peter Mandelson was out of Parliament, working in the European Commission, and Gordon got him back, put him in the House of Lords, and made him Business Secretary and First Secretary of State. So it's not unprecedented on the Labour side either. Do you think he might have thought about Theresa May?
Yes, I think that's I think if you were Theresa May, you probably would have been very tempted by the role of Foreign Secretary. So I think he might have thought about Theresa May. I also stick to my view. I've got no inside information on this, but Rishi Sunak is very, very close to William Hague. William Hague was his predecessor in Richmond. And if you read William Hague in the Times, he's talking up Rishi Sunak a lot, was an early supporter of his leadership bid. I think there's a very strong likelihood he approached William Hague first. But interestingly, I think William Hague probably doesn't want to do that role. He's stepped out of the House of Lords. He's stepped out of public life. I think he's been quite grateful to do that. And remember, he stepped down a year early as Foreign Secretary. And I remember him saying to me, I was very, very shocked that he would want to step down as Foreign Secretary, because obviously it's a job that I and many, many other MPs would see as one of the great jobs in government. But he certainly found it pretty frustrating. He, I think, probably conscious maybe that Britain's power isn't all that it was. But also, a lot of the time, you feel like a traveling salesman, you know, for some foreign secretaries, basically selling British armaments abroad and stuff like that. So he may have thought, I've done that already. I don't want to do it again.
We talked recently about the whole thing about families as well. I wonder what David Cameron's wife thinks about it. Because, I mean, if he's going to do the job and do it properly, he's going to be traveling a lot. He's going to be away a lot again. He's going to be under the cosh again. He's going to be getting the scrutinized pretty heavily again. And I wonder whether I'd love to know what she's thinking about it. And while on the subject of spouses, this was on my list of things to raise and see what you thought, but it's come in from a question from Ahmed Aishar Kawi. Interesting to see the new Secretary of State for Health, Victoria Atkins, is married to the managing director of British Sugar.
And she's diabetic.
Do potential real or perceived conflicts of interest ever get discussed when reshuffling a cabinet? The truth is that they do. And that was one, because I was aware of that connection, that was one that my antennae did prick up a little bit when I saw that. That's quite, we've got a big obesity strategy apparently, and you've got the health secretary literally in bed.
I also think this live streaming, Alistair, is attempting to troll me all the time. There's people sending things like, Rory, the sticker under the cup, or wave at my six-year-old.
Well, I got one who said that my wife loves Rory more than she loves me. I get loads like that, but I just blank them out now, Rory.
You just blank them out, yeah.
But there's one there, says 17,500 viewers, GB News don't get this in a week. I don't know about that.
So there's somebody in the thread said, as a working class Tory voter, I can tell you this has finished him. So that will be the somebody in the thread here expressing the view of the right of the Conservative Party, who, like Liz Truss, like Suella Braverman, felt that Rishi Sunak betrayed Boris Johnson, felt that even though Rishi Sunak was a Brexiteer, he's too centrist for their liking, and feel that bringing in David Cameron just confirms everything that they were suspicious of right back in 2010 and that drove them to vote for UKIP, I guess.
Yeah, but I think, look, just as there's a danger in us assuming that our excellent listeners on the thread represent the totality of public opinion, so I think there's a danger of thinking that the media represent public opinion or that social media represents public opinion. And I think what this is about is trying to maybe get back in touch with those people who aren't that political, don't think about it too much, but probably don't despise John Cameron quite the way they maybe despise some of the people they've been seeing on the telly day after day, like Braverman, and not to mention, of course, Johnson and Truss. I felt rather sick seeing them at the Cenotaph yesterday. I really think it's utterly absurd that because she was Prime Minister for 10 minutes, and, you know, he having wrecked the country in so many ways, that they now, their constitutional function is an annual reminder that they were once ludicrously prime minister.
Well, so we've had the health secretary. We've talked a little bit about Steve Barclay moving to DEFRA. There's also been the loss of some pretty substantial figures who were ministers of state. So they're technically junior ministers, so they're not secretaries of state, but they're quite big figures within the party have stepped down. So Jesse Norman, so Jesse Norman in from 2010, very bright, very ambitious, was somebody who came in with me and was absolutely tipped to be in the cabinet, whose wife led on the COVID vaccine procurement. and is an academic. He stepped down from transport. Neil O'Brien, who, again, very interesting voice in the Conservative Party, sometimes quite right-wing on things like justice, sometimes quite left-wing on social justice, been working closely on issues like Leveling Up in the past. So that's a surprise resignation. Will Quince, from a younger generation, but again, had been head of a parliamentary select committee, he's gone too. George Freeman, who came in with me, who was the science minister and was the science minister for David Cameron, got back in again with Boris Johnson, retained his job under Rishi, and has really made life sciences his mission in life, has stepped down as well. So there's something interesting going on, because some of those figures are more in the center of the party. They're not sort of Nadine Dorris' usual suspects. George Freeman was a kind of Remainer.
But don't you think that'll be people who are perhaps thinking about throwing in the towel before the election and moving on as MPs?
Yeah, although I've never quite understood why you have to do that before an election. You're right, a lot of people do, because they want to look for a job before an election, and they think if they get out ahead of the queue of everybody else. I think there is a fear amongst MPs, particularly Conservative MPs. If the current polls hold and Keir Starmer gets in with a 20-point majority, there will be hundreds of people looking for a job in a single day. So I guess people will hope to begin those conversations earlier. But I can't believe that's the only reason. I imagine that some of these people have actually been fired.
There's a great question here from Yellow Letters. How come only some MPs are able to say they've been sacked? Rachel McLean said she'd been sacked, whereas Therese Coffey says she has resigned. I know quite a lot about that.
Tell us about that. What is the difference between being sacked and saying you've resigned?
Well, basically, what nice, kind prime ministers tend to do in some circumstances is to alert people to the fact that it is highly likely that come the reshuffle, they will not be in a job. So they might start to prepare a letter that can be put out that says, I've decided now is the time to spend a little bit more time with my family and pruning my roses. Whereas Rachel McLean, I suspect, wanted to make a point. The point being that this guy isn't taking housing seriously if he, you know, puts in his 16th housing minister.
Yeah, so that's right, isn't it? That most of the people, not all of them, some of them will genuinely have resigned, but most of them basically have been politely sacked.
Yeah.
And some of them will take the opportunity to say I've resigned, and some of them will say, over my dead body, I'm sticking here, you're going to have to fire me.
Are you genuinely disappointed that the call to elevate Lord Stewart didn't come? And
I don't think it's realistic. I think one of the things we've decided to do, Alistair, is to try to be pretty open and blunt. And I don't think I can get away, have my cake and eat it,
being quite so rude about the Conservative government
and expect to be the Foreign Secretary.
Okay. Now, unless he changes the Foreign Office setup, I think I'm right in saying that Andrew Mitchell is now the senior Foreign Office Minister in the House of Commons. So that means we now have a Foreign Secretary in the House of Lords and a Foreign Minister in the House of Commons who is absolutely of the view that 0.7% of GDP should go on development, and indeed that getting rid of DFID was a terrible mistake by Johnson. So I wonder if that's one little sliver of good news out of this.
Yes, I think it could be, because, of course, David Cameron really embraced that commitment that was made under you guys. So that commitment to spend 0.7% of GDP on international aid was made under the Blair Brown government. But Cameron brought it into law and actually hit the target. So when he came in 2015, Britain was spending about £6 billion a year in international aid. And as we've discussed, during austerity, he increased that spend to £13 billion. So he put another £7 billion a year into international development. And he saw this and gay marriage as two of his really big achievements that he talks about a lot. And since he's left, he's been doing quite a lot with international aid, and he wrote a big paper on international governance. So I think there's, and of course, Andrew Mitchell was his international development secretary. Mm. So that pairing should be very good for development. Also, a bit of a shout out for Andrew Mitchell. He's just brought together a white paper that he's about to release. We'll get hopefully a bit of an early glimpse of it before it's released to the public. But I think there's going to be some promising things about some of the movements in which international development might go, which hopefully will get cross-party approval.
Of course, if David Cameron is put up in front of the media, let's just say that this becomes one of the threads that the media decide is an interesting one to pursue, but Sunak, in a sense, puts him in his box and says, no, we're not shifting on that because that's going to set off flares with these crazy people on the right. Then, of course, that weakens the attempt to use Cameron to change the look, the image, the brand, call it what you will. So I think this is one of those things that, frankly, could be a good move, but could also unravel, depending, frankly, upon what Cameron now says and does and what people, what sort of demeanor people decide to take vis-a-vis him, both inside the Conservative Party, but also the media and the public.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and just a final thing, which we often say in reshuffles, remember,
it doesn't change much.
Well, no, but also remember how bizarrely amateur the system is that these people will be expected. I mean, I remember this when I was moved. I was moved. I think I had 5 ministerial jobs in just about 3 years. And what people maybe don't quite understand from the outside is that within 2 days of your new job, you can be standing in the House of Commons answering questions on your new brief. I want to change the system. And I'd like Keir Starmer to sign up for this, to say people should spend a minimum of 2 years in their role as a minister. And that when they take over, there should be a 3-week training period to get them up to speed. Somebody's pointed out that James Cleverly's gone from foreign secretary to home secretary. So he will have had to, when he became foreign secretary, very rapidly learn about 150 countries that he knew next to nothing about. He would have had to try to memorize the names of their presidents, find out how big they are. Now he's responsible for the whole of the police, the whole of the security service, all of immigration, terrorism, so responses in the UK. And he's going to be standing up within 2-3 days, having to be confident about all those things.
Yeah. Well, look, we've whittled on wrong enough. We should probably plug Comfort Eero on leading, and we should say that
No, but wait. I have one for you quickly, a football one, which has just streamed up. I don't know. I'm going to bring it back. It's a football one. Actually, it's asked to me, but I'm going to ask it to you. Cool. So can Rory, insert Alistair, explain the Cameron appointment in football terms, please? Is it like Ronaldo returning to United or Mourinho returning to Chelsea?
Oh, it's a good one. I'd say it's like Darren Anderton coming back for the next World Cup. I'll even go Darren Bent. It's like Darren Bent.
No, come on, it's more than Darren Bent. It's more like
it's more Darren Bent.
It's more like some star player who may be getting a bit old, isn't it? Isn't it like somebody who played in the World Cup but is now getting a bit creaky?
Yeah, I don't want
Stephen Gerrard being brought back.
I don't want to flatter Cameron enough to say it's like Gazza, but I guess it's like Gazza coming back in 2010. it's that kind of thing. Now, listen, those of us, those people who've been watching us live, we'd be very interested to know whether you've enjoyed this experience of us sort of trying to talk to each other while reading your thousands of comments coming in.
And also abusing the bottom of my... People keep saying, have I looked at the label at the bottom of my mug?
It's only a bloody label. People get obsessed about the wrong thing. Here's the problem with the modern world, Rory. We care far too much about things that don't matter and not enough about things that do.
Exactly.
I don't give a damn about the label on you.
Thank you very much. The real question that we should have been focused on is, what is Cameron's policy going to be on Israel-Gaza?
Yeah,
because he was a big backer of Israel. He's now right in the center of this. And that, for our podcast tomorrow morning, is going to be more of a question than the label on the bottom of my mug.
I think so. We'll talk about that. Now, anybody who enjoyed this and wants to encourage us to do more, then I suggest that you subscribe to the Rest Is Politics YouTube channel. Shout out for Comfort Eero. I listened back to it today on the train up to a school in Bedford, and I thought it was really good, really interesting woman, actually. Do you find this, Rory? I don't know if you listen back, but when we're doing the podcasts, doing the interviews, I'm so focused on doing the interview that I get a completely different experience when I listen back to it.
I think that's right. I also love the fact, if anybody's thinking of doing a podcast who's listening to this, I like the fact there's two of us, because it means when you're asking a question, I can be listening to her answer to you. and thinking about a new direction to go in. I like the dynamic of having two people interviewing. Yeah. I guess a bit of a luxury, but I would encourage anyone podcasting for two people.
That's why it's very, very important that your sycophantic text to Rishi Sunak didn't result in you being put in house rules and
I did take advice from you on the texts. So Comfort Aero on leading, definitely worth listening to. And we'll be back again very, very soon with the podcast and with the question time. Oh, incidentally, Alistair, at one point I think we had nearly three times as many people listening to us as we had in our Royal Albert Hall show.
Okay.
So that's so worth doing, maybe even for us. Good. Yeah, there we are.
Yeah, good. We could just live our lives on YouTube. You in a sort of dodgy hotel room.
Do you like my hotel room? Do you think it looks good?
Do you like my new backdrop?
Screw that up. Yeah, it's lovely. I like the dark in the back. Yeah. I like the wall art in my hotel room. Look at that. Beautiful.
It's not nice.
Oh dear, I wanted to say that.
I was commenting on that before you arrived, actually.
All right, okay. Time to end. Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.